When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
...32-year-old Naomi Wilson was well on her way to building the life she'd always dreamed of. There'd been a few bumps along the way, leaving her home state, moving to the big city, and one failed marriage. Regardless of the challenges life threw at her, Naomi was never the type to back down. She knew what she wanted, and she was going to make sure she got it. She picked up work at a factory and quickly climbed the ladder. She bought a new car, made a down payment on a house, and moved into the first home that she owned all on her own. She had big plans. Keep saving up for renovations, new furniture, all the comforts of a home made by the sweat of her brow and the drive of her mind. It was finally coming together, until the day she mysteriously vanished. It was a quiet Sunday afternoon in Cedar Rapids. Leaving her home that day, the 32-year-old set off to fill her gas tank and then enjoy the laughter and company of a friend. She'd never arrived, though, and what exactly happened to Naomi Wilson has been the source of one of Iowa's oldest, coldest, and most haunting missing persons cases in history. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 187, The Disappearance of Naomi Wilson. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we'll examine the disappearance of Naomi Wilson, a case with almost no evidence and a countless number of questions which have never been answered. Before getting into that, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. For more information, visit crimecon.com and remember to use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I look forward to seeing you there. 32-year-old Naomi Wilson was at the precipice of a new life. She'd bought a car, a house, and was working on renovating it and adding furniture. She had a lot of big plans for the future, and everyone who knew her said she was always the type who knew exactly where she was going. That is, until the Sunday afternoon when she mysteriously vanished. This is episode 187, The Disappearance of Naomi Wilson. On a quiet Tuesday afternoon, cars zoomed around the curving of the highway. One by one, they passed the nearly empty parking lot of a Kmart shopping center, paying no attention to the white car that had been sitting there for days. The radio was quiet, the television hadn't yet mentioned it, and for the vast majority of those living in the busy city of Cedar Rapids, they were completely unaware that just 2 days earlier, 32-year-old Naomi Wilson had left her 13th Avenue home and never returned. She'd become the third person reported missing that year, and now, more than 40 years later, the mystery of her final days and hours endures, wrapped in a series of unanswered questions and surrounded by an air of suspicion which remains to be cleared. Naomi Pollard was born on Friday, August 20th, 1948, in Birmingham, Alabama, to parents George and Harriet. Naomi was the only daughter born to the couple, who would have five children, giving Naomi a few older and younger brothers. While details about Naomi's childhood are few and far between, the most prominent information describes her as a deeply loving, caring, and intelligent child who was adored by her parents and brothers alike. While we don't have a great wealth of knowledge about Naomi's specific upbringing in early years, it wouldn't be difficult to assume that she and her family were likely to have encouraged difficulties and challenges on the road to living life by their own terms. Being born in 1948, Naomi would have been 6 years old when Brown versus the Board of Education ruled that segregation in school was unconstitutional, and yet 9 years later in 1963, when Naomi would have been 15, the world watched live on television as President Kennedy sent in the Alabama National Guard to remove then-Governor George Wallace, who stood in the doorway in an attempt to block black students from getting entry into the University of Alabama. Despite any roadblock that was thrown up in her way, Naomi pushed through, and by the time she completed high school, she'd already garnered a reputation for being a level-headed, thoughtful woman who knew how to negotiate when the situation called for it, but also didn't shy away from telling things like they were. If she saw something happening that she disagreed with, or was treated in a way that she felt was out of line, she had no problem standing up for herself and speaking her mind. Suffice it to say, a common description of Naomi labels her as one without the time nor the inclination to beat around the bush. Graduating from high school in Alabama, Naomi didn't stick around her home state long. Not even 20 years old, she packed up her belongings and made the long trip north and settled in Chicago. Ready to take on the world and carve out a future for herself, Naomi entered a new city in search of her dreams. Not much is known about this time in Naomi's life, though there is one detail that would play a pivotal role in forever changing her direction. While living in Chicago, Naomi would eventually meet and fall in love with Benny D. Wilson. Benny was just a year younger than Naomi, but the two bonded quickly and their relationship evolved rapidly. By the early 1970s, the couple were married, and while they continued living in Chicago, they'd eventually leave the Windy City behind, turning west towards Iowa, where a large chunk of Benny's family already lived. Together, they moved to Cedar Rapids, a quickly growing city in Linn County, quite smaller than both Chicago and Birmingham, but it was a city on the rise, and there were a lot of opportunities to build life on new foundations. Unfortunately, Naomi and Benny's relationship began to hit the rocks after their arrival in Iowa, and while they'd hoped a change of scenery might help them reforge their bond, instead, it only quickened the deterioration of their marriage. The two would separate and file for divorce. By the summer of 1978, Naomi was nearly 30 years old and single for the first time since she'd arrived in Chicago more than a decade earlier, though that wouldn't last long. Shortly after the divorce was finalized, Naomi embarked upon a new relationship, though it would be with a familiar face. Colbert Beats, or Billy, as he preferred to be known, was Benny's uncle. So when he began seeing Naomi, as you might imagine, there was a considerable amount of strife stirred up. Benny stuck around Cedar Rapids for a little while, though it appears he began to grow distant from his family, and given how things had developed, it isn't hard to imagine why. He'd eventually move on with his life, marrying and moving out of the state to Colorado, where he settled and began a new family, far from Iowa, and the memories of his marriage and the uncle who was now dating his ex-wife. Unfortunately, while things may have calmed and the passage of time helped ease the difficulty of this complicated situation, Billy may in fact have represented a turning of the tide that would steer Naomi away from the future she craved and towards the dark mystery from which she never emerged. According to the Cedar Rapids Gazette, by the beginning of 1980, Naomi, now 31 years old, was well on track for building the life she desired. She'd picked up work at the Harnischweger Corporation, which is listed as producing construction machinery and equipment. At first, she was hired on to work in materials handling, though she'd received several promotions and wound up being assigned to one of the factory's checkpoints. According to her brother, John, she was making $1,000 a month working at the plant. Now making decent money, in July of 1980, Naomi purchased the first and only home she'd own on her own, located in the 1600 block of 13th Avenue Southeast, just 3 miles south of the factory where she worked. Excited about the way things were coming together, Naomi still had some changes she wanted to make. She couldn't afford to remodel the home and get all new furniture at the same time, so she worked on things one piece at a time. Fix an issue here, buy a chair or a table there. She didn't mind the time it took, however, as she saw it all as steps towards creating a true home, all for herself. Despite her apparent relationship with Billy, it didn't appear as though there were ever any plans for him to move in. And while no one can say for certain, it has been suggested that given her first experience, Naomi wasn't yet open to the idea of marrying again. By the beginning of 1981, things were still much the same. Naomi continued to work on her home, investing in furniture and new belongings, while having work done to fix up the house, which had been built in the mid-1950s. At work, Naomi made friends with several people, and she was described as being reliable, dependable, and having an incredible work ethic. Back home, there are less details about what was going on in her private life, though it appears she was still dating Billy. Depending on the source, the relationship has been described either as a happy one with no real issues, or there were several issues, and confrontations between the two were becoming more frequent and more heated. Now, this is where we're going to have to take several details into consideration before moving forward. Firstly, very few details about the investigation into Naomi's disappearance have ever been revealed. Detectives have stated that they have hundreds of pages of case files, but a severe lack of evidence. That being said, secondly, and perhaps most importantly, everything we know about the last day Naomi was seen alive comes from only one source, Colbert Billy Beats, the last person confirmed to have seen the 32-year-old. On Friday, April 10th, Naomi arrived for her normal shift at work and, according to coworkers, didn't seem to be stressed out or worried about anything in particular. When she left work later that day, that's the last time anyone outside of her boyfriend has confirmed seeing her. What exactly happened between Friday the 10th and Monday the 13th remains unknown. According to Billy Beats, the last time he saw Naomi was on the morning of Sunday, April 12th. According to the Gazette, Beats told investigators that his Sunday morning didn't begin as it usually did. Most Sundays, he and Naomi would get up and have breakfast before heading off to Sunday afternoon service at the church where his brothers, Wendell and Paul, were reverends. At the time, the church was located at 2325 16th Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids, approximately 4 miles southwest of Naomi's home at 1618 13th Avenue Southeast. On this particular Sunday, however, for reasons unknown, Naomi didn't attend the 12 p.m. church service, and Billy went by himself. According to the Gazette, Billy later told police that Naomi had made plans to visit a female friend and coworker later in the afternoon. Following the church service, Billy claims to have arrived back at Naomi's house at approximately 4 p.m. and found that she was still home. He then stated that Naomi told him she was going to gas up her car, a white 1978 Ford Fairmont, and from there she'd go to visit her friend. Billy stated that he and Naomi both left the 13th Avenue home within minutes of each other between 4 and 4:10 p.m. Neither the name nor address of Naomi's coworker has ever been revealed, so what direction she may have headed in is unknown. While we don't know where Naomi went that afternoon, Billy did fill in police about his travels. According to his statement, after saying goodbye to Naomi, he then picked up some ice cream and proceeded on to his mother's home, which according to records of the time, was located in the 1000 block of 9th Street Southeast, approximately 3/4 of a mile northwest of Naomi's house. Billy last claims to have seen Naomi an hour later at approximately 5:15 p.m. According to his statement, He was driving down the street, at which time Naomi drove past him in her car. Unfortunately, no further information is revealed about where he was driving, nor what street he saw her on. This is recorded as the last official sighting of Naomi Wilson. According to Billy, he returned to Naomi's house shortly after passing her on the road, but found that she wasn't there. At the time, he entered the house where he planned to wait for his girlfriend to return, but she never did. Billy then says that when Naomi hadn't made it back by evening, he went out and began searching for her, a search which he claims to have conducted until approximately 3 a.m., a little less than 10 hours after he last reported seeing her. By 3 a.m., having not found her, Beats didn't go to report her missing to the police, nor did he reach out to friends or family, or even his own family. He went home and went to sleep, figuring that she'd turn up the next day. On the morning of Monday, April 13th, Billy claims that he reached out to friends and family this time, saying that Naomi hadn't come home and he needed help finding her. Several people, a total number is never given, began driving around Cedar Rapids on the lookout for Naomi, her car, or anyone who may have seen her, but apparently they weren't able to track down any trace of the missing 32-year-old. So, you'd imagine that after more than 24 hours had passed, Billy might be inclined to report his girlfriend missing, but once again, you'd be wrong. He simply continued searching on his own and with those who were helping him. Naomi's not reported missing until later that night, when a coworker and friend called to report that she never showed up for her shift at work. Naomi often worked overnights and wasn't due in until 7 or 8 p.m. Asked about this later, Billy explained to the Gazette why he waited approximately 27 hours before reporting her missing, saying, quote, "I still didn't report it to police, and I still didn't put it out on the street because I didn't want to get everyone all stirred up and have her drive up all of a sudden," end quote. According to the Gazette, following the report that Naomi was missing, things didn't exactly move along as quickly as you'd hope. Police reportedly issued a be-on-the-lookout report describing both Naomi and her car, but it doesn't appear there were any officers actually out actively searching. Instead, it seems, they decided to just keep their eyes open should they come across her or the car, referencing back to the fact that, at the time, they had no indication of foul play, nor did they know if Naomi were actually missing, or if, perhaps, she was just trying to avoid her boyfriend. Billy would go on to say that he felt police didn't take the report seriously, telling the Gazette that on the morning of Tuesday, April 14th, he was out searching for Naomi when he saw a police cruiser. Flagging down the vehicle, Billy states that he asked the officer driving if Naomi's car had been found yet, at which time the officer replied that he was unaware of any report to be on the lookout for a white Fairmont. Billy felt in that moment that his report had gone entirely ignored, saying, quote, "I don't believe they even looked for the car," end quote. At 2:55 p.m. that Tuesday, one of Billy's brothers, whose name is never reported, contacted the Cedar Rapids Police Department declaring that he'd located the car. The vehicle, when found, was sitting in the parking lot of what was then a Kmart shopping center at 2727 16th Avenue Southwest, just 4 miles from Naomi's home and less than 1,500 feet from Wendell Beats Church, the same one that Billy claims to have attended services at the Sunday that Naomi went missing. Somehow, in their desperate search for Naomi, no one thought to look in an area less than 4 miles away, nor one that could be clearly seen from the parking lot of the church where at least 2 members of the Beats family were employed. Upon receiving notification of the vehicle being found, 3 detectives were assigned to the case and arrived at the Kmart parking lot as the car was being processed. Police later reported that they found no evidence of foul play at the scene, nor anything to indicate where Naomi may have gone, or even whether or not she had been the one who left the car there. According to Billy Beats, police didn't fingerprint the vehicle nor complete any sweeps for evidence. He claims that after looking through the car and checking the trunk, they handed possession of it over to him, allowing him to drive it home. Beats would later say this shows that investigators were not taking the case seriously, though when asked why he didn't ask police about fingerprinting the car or taking it in to examine it more closely, he provided no answers. Assistant Chief of Police James Barnes oversaw the early stage of the investigation. though he confirmed to reporters that they didn't find any evidence, nor had they found any witnesses who had seen Naomi in the days or hours prior to her disappearance on Sunday the 12th. Asked about the possibility that she may have run off willingly, Barnes told the Gazette, quote, "From what we found out about her, it's not like her to not show up for work. She had good work habits," end quote. On the morning of Wednesday, April 15th, the Beetz family began organizing a group of volunteers, totaling approximately 30 people, to conduct a search for Naomi. The Reverend Paul Beetz arrived at the offices of the Linn County Civil Defense Department, where he requested to borrow 4 walkie-talkies to assist in coordinating the search. Bill Bjornsson, then Civil Defense Director, offered to come along and provide whatever help he could in the organization and execution. Bjornsson later told the Gazette, quote, "I went out there and showed them how to set up a search pattern. We checked through a big forested area near the parking lot behind the truck service center to the east of Kmart. We formed lines and crisscrossed a huge area. We didn't find anything," end quote. The Cedar Rapids police also joined in on the search, using helicopters and officers on the ground. Wallace Johnson, then assistant chief of police in charge of the patrol division, reported the same findings of Bjornsson. Not a single trace of Naomi, nor a clue to her whereabouts. Reports of Naomi's disappearance were aired over the radio, with her being described as having last been seen wearing a black 2-piece pantsuit and a white top. They also issued reports describing the car, asking that anyone who had seen Naomi or her vehicle please notify authorities, but as it seems, no calls came in. There were no sightings of the 32-year-old, and it seemed that between leaving work on Friday the 10th and disappearing on Sunday the 12th, no one had seen her at all. Within days of Naomi's disappearance, her 2 still-living brothers, John and Lorenzo, living in the Atlanta area at the time, flew up to Iowa to assist in searches. Speaking to the Gazette, John was quick to dismiss any possibility that his sister would have run off without telling anyone, explaining, quote, "She's very level-headed. She thinks about building up her life in many ways. It's most unusual for someone to up and leave a job where you're making $1,000 a month. She's acquired furniture, a car, and bought a house last July. She's been buying things to fix up the house," end quote. Lorenzo agreed, as did Billy, who stated that he believed something had to have happened to Naomi, otherwise she'd have come home. She wouldn't want to worry her family, especially her parents who were getting older and had already suffered through the tragic deaths of 2 of her brothers, one in 1958 and one in 1972. Unfortunately, subsequent searches for Naomi turned up the same results as the previous ones. No evidence, no clues, no sightings, nothing to indicate what may have happened. While police couldn't make a direct statement based on any particular evidence, several unnamed sources from within the department told reporters it was believed that Naomi had been the victim of foul play, and no one working her case believed her disappearance was, in any way, a result of her own decisions. Asked about progress on the investigation, Naomi's brother John told the Gazette, quote, "I think they've done a poor job. I don't think they took the missing person report seriously when it was first reported. Being from the South and being black, I grew up knowing that if you're white, the police jump on the case. If you're black, they wait around a little before acting. I guess I have a positive attitude. I don't have that gut feeling that something is wrong with her right now," end quote. John went on to state that he hoped, were someone holding Naomi against her will, that she'd be able to break free and call her family. Unfortunately, as April came to an end, Naomi's brothers had to return to their homes and jobs. They couldn't continue to stay in Iowa searching for her. For police, too, they kept hitting dead ends, and with no evidence and no witnesses, detectives were slowly being rotated into other cases. The investigation into Naomi's disappearance remained open, but without something more to work with, the likelihood of solving it was shrinking with each passing day. The next month, in May, officers stopped a vehicle where one of the women refused to give her name or show identification. At the time, they thought maybe it was Naomi, but it later turned out to be a woman named Bridget Jenkins who had warrants out for her arrest. For a moment, there had been hope, but it was quickly dashed, and Naomi's case fell silent again. While the storm initially kicked up around Naomi's disappearance was growing morbidly calm, Billy Beats was never far from the eye of the hurricane. However, whereas you might expect him to have launched additional searches or to have fought to get the word out and keep the case alive, he did something very different. According to Iowa Cold Cases, by September of 1981, just 5 months after Naomi had last been seen, Billy moved into her 13th Avenue home. He wasn't paying the mortgage or covering any of the bills, though. He was simply living there, and he'd continue to do so even as the bank sent threats of foreclosure without payment. As the record shows, Beats never made a single payment. Public postings in the Gazette by the Banco Mortgage Company showed that Naomi still owed just over $37,000 on the home, and no payments had been made prior to her disappearance. The state eventually appointed a conservator to take charge of the situation, however. Following his evaluation, no additional payments were made. Billy Beats was forced to move out as the foreclosure began in January of 1982, and then in August, 16 months after Naomi vanished, her home was seized due to lack of payments and was auctioned off at the Linn County Courthouse. Unfortunately, Naomi's case continued growing cold during this time. A year later, in September of 83, Assistant Chief of Police James Barnes was interviewed by the Gazette and asked about the status of several missing persons cases, including Naomi's. Barnes explained that, without evidence or new clues, Naomi's case continued to be held open, but there was little, if any, day-to-day investigation occurring. Publicly, the Cedar Rapids police would not confirm whether or not they believed Naomi had been the victim of foul play, though sources claim that it was believed she was dead. Whether or not that was the result of murder, however, no one was willing to comment on. 5 long years later, in May of 1988, police received a call from two men who'd been out hunting for mushrooms in a rural area off Old Ely Road. These men reported that during their hunt, they'd stumbled upon what appeared to be an unmarked grave. On Thursday, May 13th, a large group of officers dressed in coveralls and carrying shovels hiked into the area in search of the grave. They eventually found a mound of dirt, approximately 2.5 feet wide by 5 feet long. Wondering if perhaps they were going to find human remains, they began excavating the site over the course of several hours. Asked about this, and whether or not it could possibly be Naomi, Assistant Chief Barnes told the Gazette, quote, "I always think of her. She was a nice, responsible woman, had a good job, money in the bank, and then one day they found her car in the parking lot out at Kmart. She disappeared. She goes through your mind at a time like that, or maybe it could be a new one we don't even know about yet. It really looks suspicious. They wouldn't need it big enough to lay someone in. They just toss the person in and cover it up." End quote. Unfortunately, several days later, police announced that the excavation of the grave hadn't resulted in the discovery of any evidence or human remains. At the time, they weren't sure whether the site had previously held a body, which may have been moved in the days or weeks before it was found, or if someone in the area had dug the grave in preparation for a crime which hadn't yet been committed. However, without any evidence as to the purpose for the hole, investigators noted it was also possible that someone had dug the grave as some sort of a sick joke. While Naomi's name had reached the headlines again due to this dig, it vanished from the media almost as quickly as it had arrived. Sadly, this is where we come to the end of the line. As of the most recent discussions of Naomi's disappearance, the Cedar Rapids police have acknowledged that the case remains open, though it's designated cold and no one is actively working it. According to investigators, due to the severe lack of evidence they had, the investigation was never able to really build up a great deal of steam, and they began running into dead ends within days of launching their search. Off the record, several detectives told reporters that they did in fact have someone in mind, but they didn't possess what they needed to officially name that person as a suspect. Asked to give further details, no one was willing to comment about the possibility of murder or what made them suspicious of this person in the first place. When last seen, Naomi Pollard Wilson was described as being a black female with brown hair and brown eyes, standing 5 feet, 3 inches tall and weighing approximately 112 pounds. Naomi's ears are pierced, though no other distinguishing marks or jewelry is listed. She was last seen wearing a black two-piece pantsuit with a white top and was heading to fill up her gas in their car, a 1978 white Ford Fairmont with the license plate DOY622. Naomi was last seen in the vicinity of her home in the 1600 block of 13th Avenue Southeast, and her car was found at the old Kmart in the 2700 block of 16th Avenue, less than 4 miles away. At the time of her disappearance, Naomi was 32 years old, and if alive today, she would be turning 73 this year. She has been missing for more than 40 years, 8 years longer than she was alive and living her life. More than four decades have passed, and yet there have been almost no developments in Naomi's case. Sadly, both Naomi's mother and father have since passed away, never learning the fate of their daughter. In 2010, a volunteer working with the Doan Network managed to get in touch with Naomi's brother, John. It was at that time that family members submitted DNA samples so that Naomi could be checked against the vast list of unidentified victims. There were no matches. However, this led to Naomi finally obtaining an entry on NamUs. She has since been compared to and ruled out against 4 unidentified victims. While few believe that the answers are going to be found anytime soon, Naomi's friends and remaining family continue to hope that someday they'll know what happened to the brilliant, kind, and beautiful woman they lost so long ago. Do you know why free trials renew without your consent? It's a business scam out to get you. Don't let greedy corporations pocket your money. Download Truebill to take control of your subscriptions. Truebill is the new app that helps you identify and stop paying for subscriptions you don't need, want, or simply forgot about. On average, people save up to $720 a year with Truebill. Because companies make subscriptions hard to cancel, Truebill makes it incredibly simple. Just link your accounts and Truebill will cancel your unwanted subscriptions in one tap. And Truebill Concierge is there for you when you need them to cancel unwanted subscriptions so you don't have to. Truebill is so easy to use and brought to light subscriptions I didn't even know I was paying for anymore. Once I eliminated the unwanted subs, I was surprised by how much money I'd been wasting on accounts I didn't even use. I love Truebill. They've saved me hundreds of dollars. I use Truebill, and you should too. Save like Becca L., who says, quote, "Hands down, the best financial app I discovered. In my first week, I opened up $187 in unused recurring subscriptions. I'm obsessed. I never want to manage finances without Truebill again," end quote. Don't fall for subscription scams. Start canceling today at Truebill.com/trace. Go right now. Truebill.com/trace. It could save you thousands a year. Truebill.com/trace. There's nothing better than curling up on the couch and watching a great mystery thriller. Pop some popcorn, grab a warm blanket, and settle in for a night of thrills and chills. If you're like me and you love a good mystery, then I've got the perfect one for you to watch next. Spectrum Originals' Angela Black. The great part is, you don't have to linger on a cliffhanger waiting to see what happens. You can binge all of the episodes for free on demand on Spectrum now. In this new, character-driven, 6-part psychological thriller, you follow Angela Black, a woman whose reality is upended when she's approached by a mysterious man carrying an ominous warning. Nothing is as it seems as she tries to save herself and her children from danger, leading Angela to doubt everything she thought she knew, including her own mind. All episodes of Angela Black are available to binge now, free on demand on Spectrum. The series stars actors we've all loved, from Golden Globe winner Joanna Froggatt, who played Anna Bates in Downton Abbey, to Mikiel Huseman from The Flight Attendant. The minute I saw the Angela Black trailer, I knew I'd binge the entire series. I was immediately sucked into this dark, slow-burning thriller that transforms the quiet comfort of your own home into a space reserved for terror. I'm telling you, you have to start watching Angela Black today. Binge all of the episodes for free on demand on Spectrum Now. That's Spectrum Originals, Angela Black. The disappearance of Naomi Wilson is a case I've wanted to cover for a long time. I wrote the first draft of this episode in early 2021, and then I tried to flesh it out more throughout the year and stopped in December. Unfortunately, I've run into the same issues every time I've tried. This is a case of a missing person where there's so little known about the investigation or Naomi's life itself that it's incredibly difficult to stitch it all together. Due to the case still being open, records requests were denied, and apparently due to someone who may or may not be a person of interest still being alive, it's unlikely any new information's going to come out unless investigators catch a major break or someone comes forward. I can't begin to explain to you how frustrating it is to dig into a case and to find not only is the case almost too thin to see, what we know about the victim is even thinner. Naomi Wilson was a hardworking 32-year-old woman living in Cedar Rapids in 1981. From what we know, the last people to see her alive were her coworkers when she left work on Friday, April 10th. From that point on, it appears the only person to see and interact with her was her then-boyfriend, Colbert Billy Beats, an uncle of her ex-husband, Benny Wilson. Now, during the evidence section, you may have noticed I threw a little bit of shade Billy's way, but it wasn't arbitrary. In a case with so few clues and no potential leads, there have only ever been two possible theories considered. That Naomi went out that Sunday afternoon, April 12, 1981, and fell victim to a complete stranger in a random act of violence, or her then-boyfriend knows more about her disappearance than he's willing to admit. So let's begin with the stranger theory, and then we'll move to Billy. Naomi was a popular, intelligent, and strong woman who made friends easily, but could also make her share of enemies. She didn't play games when it came to calling things like they were, and if someone were treating her or someone else in a way she didn't agree with, she didn't hesitate to open her mouth and speak up. While that's a highly admirable quality in a person, and frankly one I wish we saw more of, it can also cause people to want to strike back. Sometimes they'll just use words, but in other cases they may take extreme actions. Many people have speculated that perhaps Naomi spoke up to the wrong person, whether it was a coworker, a friend, or perhaps someone she never even knew. On the other hand, it's entirely possible that Naomi could have been randomly selected by someone out looking to cause harm. If indeed Naomi drove away from her home that afternoon, there's no saying who she might have run into or where it may have happened. Whatever did occur, it seems at least, probably didn't happen in her car. When her white 1978 Ford Fairmont was discovered in the Kmart parking lot 2 days later on Tuesday, April 14th, there wasn't anything to suggest foul play. No spots of blood, no signs of a struggle. The vehicle didn't appear disorganized or messy. It wasn't parked at an odd angle or in a way which suggested speed or fear. The problem is, we don't know who brought the car there in the first place. Sure, it could have been Naomi, but it also could have been the person responsible for her disappearance. If the statement of Billy Beats is true, and police didn't take fingerprints or check the car for additional evidence, who knows what valuable information may have been lost due to the failure of investigators to do their fucking jobs. But here's the problem, or at least what I view as a large problem. No one saw anything. There were no reports of a woman being chased or anyone hearing screams, no reports of the white car being pursued or anyone even seeing Naomi driving it. Hell, nobody even knows when the car got to that parking lot. It could have been the day Naomi vanished, or maybe it was just hours before it was found. That suggests that had Naomi come across someone looking to do her harm, they had quite a head start. From around 5:30 on Sunday until she was officially reported missing to police around 8 p.m. on Monday. 27 hours passed from the last time Billy says he saw Naomi and when police were told. In that span of time, someone could have abducted her and had her 100 miles away. They also could have murdered her, disposed of her remains, and been several states away by the time investigators even began looking. Unfortunately, with so little evidence, there's so many possibilities that we couldn't cover them all. I think we've seen in a lot of cases, some of which have been solved, that there are monsters out there just looking to cause harm, to rob, rape, murder, whatever, to satisfy their own vicious desires at the expense of anyone who gets in their way. And they don't always have to have a reason or even a plan. Is it possible that Naomi was accosted by someone she'd never met, who managed to pull this crime off and escape scot-free? Sadly, yes. Could she have had an enemy no one knew about? A jealous man, an angry coworker, a violent friend? Certainly. Unfortunately, without more information, it's difficult to know for certain. That, tragically, is where this case hung for more than four decades. Now, turning our attention away from a stranger and towards Billy Beats or perhaps someone in his family, what you find is a lot of speculation. We don't have any evidence that ties Billy to Naomi's disappearance, nor to any violent encounters with her prior to her disappearance. Despite this, many people have considered Billy to be their particular person of interest, but it stretches out beyond that. As it turns out, Billy wasn't the only member of his family who may have had a reason to want to eliminate Naomi, or anyone else in general. In order to properly discuss it, I think it's necessary for me to fill you in on some of the details regarding the Beats family themselves. Jody Ewing launched the website iowacoldcases.org in 2005. Beginning with just a handful of cases, the site now hosts information regarding more than 600 unsolved cases from across the state. Through her hard work and dedication to the unsolved crimes of Iowa, one of which resulted in the death of her own father, Jody has created an expansive database with case files, maps, suspect descriptions, and news articles connected to every story. It's truly a marvelous resource, and one which I would highly recommend you take a look at if you're interested in Naomi's case or any unsolved cases in Iowa. Why am I mentioning all this? Because without that site, this episode simply would not have been possible. However, while it gives details almost everything that's known about Naomi's case, it goes a step further and gives us a glimpse into the Beats family and many members' history of arrests and encounters with police. According to Iowa Cold Cases, in 1968, Wendell Beats, one of Billy's brothers, fled the state after arrest warrants were issued for 15 counts of writing bad checks plus one charge for forgery. This came less than half a year after Wendell had received a 30-day suspended sentence for bad checks in 67. On April 30th, according to the Gazette, Wendell was tracked down in Thornton, Arkansas, and was returned to Cedar Rapids, where he received a 7-year sentence and was later placed on probation under the condition that Reverend John Thomas ensure Beats made restitution for his fraudulent checks. On Saturday, July 11th, 1970, 18-year-old Paula Jean Oberbrockling went missing after leaving her Cedar Rapids home located at 116 10th Street Northwest. At the time, Paula shared the home with a friend, Debbie Kellogg, who later told police that Paula had returned home from a date with her boyfriend on Friday. The two argued, and Paula asked to borrow Debbie's car, to which she agreed. Paula never made it back home, driving off into the unknown in the early morning hours. The next day, Sunday, July 12th, Debbie's car was found near the Eagle Supermarket on 14th Street, approximately 2 miles east of where she and Paula lived. It's interesting to note that the location of the car is not far from a home where Naomi's ex-husband, Benny Wilson, had previously lived, and is also the site where one of Billy's nephews later smashed his car into the same dwelling after rear-ending another vehicle. According to Paula's mother, Carol, her daughter was worried that she might have been in the early stages of a pregnancy and that her boyfriend was trying to cut loose of his responsibilities. Carol went out knocking on doors trying to get information from anyone who may have seen Paula in the hours surrounding her disappearance. One witness claimed to have seen Paula at approximately 1 a.m. on Saturday, apparently experiencing car trouble. This witness claimed to have seen a black male helping Paula. Lonnie Bell told police that Paula had been exchanging letters with a black male named John Strayhorn, who rented an apartment at Hawthorne Hills, though when police followed up, they couldn't find anyone of that name registered there. 2 months later, on Sunday, November 29th, Paula's body was found off Otis Road near the old railroad tracks across from a waste treatment plant. Her ankles were bound and her wrists were tied behind her back. The killer had used two separate items, a plastic clothesline and another unknown type of cord. The autopsy wasn't able to provide an exact determination of what had happened, with the pathologist writing that Paula's death may have been the result of soft tissue injuries, poisoning, asphyxiation, or a combination of all three. Paula's case has never been solved. However, multiple sites have reported that Cedar Rapids' former police chief believed that Wendell Beetz knew the truth and allegedly possessed knowledge that one of his own daughters may have been involved in the crime. It has since been speculated that perhaps Paula had dated a man that one of Wendell's daughters was interested in. 11 years later, in April of 1981, Naomi Wilson went mysteriously missing from her home. Her then-boyfriend Colbert Billy Beetz, Wendell's brother, reported last seeing her as she drove to go spend time with a friend. Billy doesn't report Naomi missing until he's contacted by a coworker of hers more than 24 hours later. In the months following her disappearance, he does little to aid the investigation and instead moves into Naomi's home, not paying any of the bills, staying there until it's foreclosed on. Just 2 years earlier, in 1979, Billy had filed for bankruptcy. Throughout the rest of the 80s, both Wendell and Paul Beetz continue to run the Gospel Tabernacle Church, which by this point has moved several times. In 1992, allegations arise accusing Reverend Wendell Beetz of sexually abusing a teen parishioner at his church, the New Sound Doctrine Church. Following the allegations, several others come forward telling similar stories, and shockingly, in August of 92, Wendell confesses in front of 50 congregants to having taken part in sexual impropriety and misdeeds. He then resigns from his church and leaves town with his family. Authorities issued a warrant for Beetz's arrest related to sexual assault, and he's arrested in September and charged with criminal sexual misconduct. In December, he's found guilty by a district court judge of assault with intent to commit sexual abuse against one of his female former congregants. Less than 2 years later, in 1995, Wendell Beetz and his brother, Colbert Billy Beetz, are listed as reverends at the Gospel Tabernacle Church. In November of that same year, one of Billy's sons, 31-year-old Tony, is charged with felony assault with intent to commit sexual abuse and bodily harm after he breaks into the house of a female acquaintance brandishing a knife. He strikes the woman and announces his intent to rape her, but she luckily manages to escape. 2 years later, in 1997, Richard Beetz, the 33-year-old son of Reverend Paul Beetz, dies as the result of drowning. His death is later ruled to have been the result of suicide, and his memorial service is overseen by Wendell Beetz, who at the time was listed as an elder at the Gospel Tabernacle Church. On November 5, 2003, 21-year-old Marcus Beetz dies as the result of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. An elite drummer at the time, many of Marcus's friends and relatives admit their shock about his death, never having any indication that he might take violent actions against himself. Marcus was born to Billy Beetz in September of 1982, 17 months after Naomi's disappearance. Suffice it to say, there's a lot more to the story of these members of the Beetz family, and much of it revolves around sexual assault, unexpected or unexplained deaths, and potential links to other crimes which, as of this time, remain unsolved and cold in the state of Iowa. There are additional family members tied to charges spanning from robbery to assault to even a suspected homicide, and in other cases, sustained homicide. Now, does all of this information add up to more than circumstantial evidence at best? Not really. But it does place Naomi in and around a family where violence, sexual assault, and perhaps even murder are on the table at different points in time. It's also worth noting, as many have, that in the end, Naomi's abandoned car was found less than 1,500 feet from one of the churches where Wendell and Paul Beetz worked as reverends and where Billy claims to have attended the day she vanished. There's no evidence that links Billy to Naomi's disappearance. However, we have to consider the fact that he's the last person to have claimed to have seen her alive that Sunday in 1981. Everything we know about her disappearance comes from Billy, and he's also the same person who elected to wait more than 24 hours before reporting her missing. None of this means Billy is guilty of anything. But most who have dug into Naomi's case can't help but find their trails leading back to someone with the last name of Beats, or someone who is closely connected to that family. Unfortunately, what information these people may have possessed is lost, as many of them have since passed away. Billy hasn't, but it seems he hasn't spoken publicly about Naomi's case in nearly 40 years. Obviously, there's some information here which can appear enticing, but without additional knowledge or evidence, it becomes impossible to connect any dots. There's only one thing that we really know for certain. Someone out there knows exactly what happened to Naomi Wilson. Someone stole the life, dreams, and future of a talented, intelligent, driven, headstrong, and tough-as-nails woman, and more than four decades later, we're no closer to finding the answers nor seeing justice delivered. Unfortunately, unless new evidence is found, someone provides a much-needed tip, or Naomi's assailant is otherwise identified, this case will remain open, unsolved, and very cold.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Naomi Wilson, the Cedar Rapids Gazette was a very invaluable resource, as was iowacoldcases.org. I highly recommend you visit there and take a look at some of the more than 600 unsolved cases with detailed write-ups available. If you have any information about the disappearance of Naomi Wilson, please contact the Cedar Rapids Police Department at 319-286-5478. Her case number is 810-067-70. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloann Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sentz, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. I want to again thank you for listening to this episode, and I have a small favor I'd like to ask. I created a survey about the show. It takes less than 2 minutes to complete. I'm planning to make some adjustments moving towards episode 200, and I'd love your input. You can find the link to the survey in the show notes or on trace-evidence.com. That wraps up our look into the disappearance of Naomi Wilson. So thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.